Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And because we are kind of a maritime show, just want to give a quick shout-out to our Naval Academy compatriots and those who follow the football, of course. Congratulations again on their victory against Army. I think they've won every Army-Navy game since the Reformation, but that's okay. I've made for a lot of happy times to Annapolis. I also had a chance to talk on the phone yesterday with a couple of folks who I know will be listening either now or on archive. They're en route to the stadium, so thanks for giving a shout-out on my behalf, at least, because I was not there. Just a reminder for those that are joining us live, we've got this chat room up and running. Mr. Paul Withington, I think, is one of the usual suspects who will herd you along just fine. If you have any points of order, questions, or observations during the show you would like for Eagle One or myself to roll into the conversation, chat room is a great place to do that. Both Eagle One and I will be keeping an eye on that, and we'll pull them in as best that we can. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some previous shows, you can always get the archives over at Blog Talk Radio, or really the best way is to go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes and listen at your leisure. Also, occasionally on our shows, while you're listening live, we will keep talking through the end of the hour. You can catch that. It keeps recording. You can get it on the archive the last few minutes. That will happen sometimes when we have one more question we got to squeeze out, or our guest are in a role, and we're going to let them go. So you can always, again, catch that on the archive. You won't miss anything in that respect. Now let's get on with the show. It's that time of year in early December where, of course, everybody starts thinking about Christmas. But for those of the maritime persuasion, it is a time where we think back to the kickoff for World War II for the Americans, and that was the attack on Pearl Harbor. A lot of the discussions that goes on, because obviously from an American perspective, there's a lot of discussion of missed opportunities, a lot of negativity, you know, who's guilty for this, who did this wrong, who could have done this better. But there's a different side to that story. If you look at it strictly from a neutral perspective, or even if you wanted to take yourself out and put yourself in and look at it from the Japanese perspective, there was a lot that went right at Pearl Harbor at the tactical and operational level, especially in the couple of years that we're moving up to Pearl Harbor. There's a couple of things that happened that are very good to keep in mind today as you look at other potential adversaries out there and some of the assumptions that we make about them that may or may not be accurate. Our guest to discuss for the full hour some of these less understood aspects of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the developments in the Imperial Japanese Navy is one of the co-authors of a great article in December's Naval Institute Naval History Magazine titled Pearl Harbor's Overlooked Answer. Jonathan Parshall will be our guest. He has authored a lot of articles pretty much running the gambit from the U.S. Naval College Review, U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings, World War II Magazine. He's also been a contributor to several books on the topic of the Imperial Japanese Navy. A little more depth in it, in 95, he co-founded a great site that he's got some other people that are doing a lot of the pushing on, www.combinedfleet.com, which is really a great resource on information on the Imperial Japanese Navy. If you've never visited it before, go over there with a cup of coffee and poke around for a while. There's some good stuff over there. He also helped out in the 1990 expedition by Nauticus Corporation and the Naval Oceanographic Office that discovered the wreck of the carrier Kaga sunk at Midway. And speaking of Midway, he's also the author of the book The Shattered Sword, which is a book that anybody who reads is going to have trouble putting down. John, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
And we're great to have you on board this Sunday. And thanks for my kind of long-winded introduction, but I really wanted to make sure and set the stage right for maybe a different conversation about the Battle of Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, depending on how you want to look at it, than what a lot of people get. And on that note, you know, kind of mentioned when we look at Pearl Harbor, we always look at it from the American point of view. But there is a different side of the story. It's a story of really short-cycled inventiveness, operational excellence, some very, very top-notch tactical leader, and something that a lot of Western navies always brag about, this sheer audacity of an operational mission. There is more to the story of Pearl Harbor, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, too, because I think the scholarship on Pearl Harbor is advancing quite nicely, and there have actually been some real advances in that respect in the last little bit. You know, from my standpoint, I look at naval evolution, the evolution of the carrier force, and, you know, really the big step forward that the Japanese had taken in the middle of 1941 was the formation of First Air Fleet, which has a tactical manifestation that we refer to as Kido Butai, the mobile striking force. And it's really the Japanese innovation of taking all of those flight decks that they had, putting them all together, being able to create large, powerful air armadas and control those once airborne, coordinate them, if you will, bring them to the target. You know, that's a pretty important step forward in the history of naval warfare, and allows them to do some things that no other navy can really do at this point in time. I mean, Pearl Harbor is not necessarily the perfectly executed attack, and I want to come back to that in just a little bit, but I think it's indisputable that at this point in time there was no other navy on the planet that could have done an attack of the scope and magnitude that the Pearl Harbor attack represented.
Well, as you look at Pearl Harbor, I think some of this was in the Naval History article, and some of it I may have gleaned from the opening parts of your book, Shattered Sword. But there were a lot of innovations that the Japanese fleet had undertaken, not just the part you just talked about, the ability to coordinate the aircraft from several different carriers all at once. But there were a number of other innovations that we seem to have lacked appropriate intelligence about. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, at this point in time, there's very little information coming out of Japan. They've done a very good job of shutting down the traditional routes of information being leaked out. So, you know, our naval attachés at that time are getting very little in the way of usable intelligence, although there are certain instances where we have become aware of some of the Japanese innovations in technology, at least, things like the Zero Fighter. There was even a mention by one naval person who had gotten a hold of some information on the Long Lance torpedo, forwarded it on to his superiors, and had been told, you know, there's no way that anybody could invent a torpedo that had these capabilities. You must be mistaken. So I think there's at least some evidence that we had our blinders on in a certain respect, and really didn't respect the Japanese Navy as a professional organization, and therefore overlooked some opportunities to get a handle on what they were up to. But in terms of what was going on with their carrier force, big picture piece number one is that they've made this decision that they're going to actually unify all of their carriers, their large flight decks, into a single tactical organization, and that gives you the ability to then coordinate the launching and sending off of these large air forces. They start beating out some sort of a reasonable tactical doctrine for controlling these forces once in the air, although they're very badly hampered by the fact that they don't really have very good radio systems in those aircraft, so it's pretty tough to replicate the sort of things that, you know, we would look at a modern force and think that there might be a, you know, a strike commander who's actually doling out targets in real time to aircraft or groups of aircraft. The Japanese really couldn't do that, and they were, you know, forced to resort to some pretty crude methods, like, you know, flare pistols, famously. They also, though, from an organizational standpoint, do away with the notion of each of the groups of aircraft being somehow tied to the carrier that it came from. So they would have, you know, one person from whatever carrier would be in charge of, say, all of the dive bombers, and another person would be in charge of all of the fighters. And that meant crossing some organizational lines that a lot of the carrier skippers weren't necessarily very happy with. They were used to having and retaining control over their own ship's aircraft. And what ends up happening in the run-up to Pearl Harbor is that Commander Genda, who's the air officer, staff officer for 1st Air Fleet, Mike Wenger's research has shown that he basically rams this innovation down the throats of the carrier commanders and said, nope, we're going to have this org structure wherein command could devolve to an aviator that is not from your ship at all. Just get over it. So there's a lot of things that take place in that time span. You know, down at the technological level, of course, they're creating things like the modified torpedoes that are going to be able to operate in shallow water. They are developing the heavy 800-kilogram armor-piercing bombs, which are, you know, machined down 16-inch naval shells. And critically, they are also putting together the rudiments of an underway refueling capability so that they can get these carriers from point A, 3,500 nautical miles across the ocean, off to the shores of Oahu. So a lot of stuff going on.
I thought one of the more interesting things is when people think in big pixels about the Japanese and really the Japanese military in particular, you have this vision of this incredibly top-down driven culture where you're very deferential to senior rank and you pretty much do what your boss wants to do and you move forward with that. But there was that, and a lot of people look at him as he grew into prominence, especially after the war. But in the 1940 time frame, I believe I'm right here, that was just a mid-grade Lieutenant Commander Genda with a good idea. And how was the role of, I guess a modern terminology would be mentorship and top cover, and the interaction in between Yamamoto and Nagumo, and how was he able to take his idea and his concept in such an incredibly short and abbreviated time frame to what we saw in December 7th?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question, actually. And, you know, I think that Genda is the beneficiary of being a little bit of a rock star. I mean, he had been a very well-known fighter pilot. He had put together a naval acrobatics unit that was going around the country and touring and sort of promoting the notion of naval aviation. And so, yeah, he's a commander, but he's a pretty high-profile commander. And I think that he moved in circles as an air power advocate where he got to rub shoulders with a lot of other pretty influential people, and those included Admirals Ozawa, Onishi, Inoue. The three of those guys were all very much air power advocates in their own right, and I think that, you know, Genda upward manages, if you will, by planting the seeds in the brains of those three gentlemen that, you know, we really need some sort of a unified carrier command here. How can we make that happen? And I haven't seen this explicitly noted, but it seems fairly clear that what ends up happening is that Yamamoto is getting pestered by Admirals Ozawa and Onishi that, you know, we should do this. And of course, at the same time, he is beginning to think forward about, you know, what happens if there is a war. How am I going to carry off my pet idea of attacking Pearl Harbor? Something like a Kido Butai would be a very useful implement. In fact, maybe the only implement that I would be able to do something like that. So I think, you know, there's a combination of factors that all come together in April 1941, where Yamamoto, A, wants this implement, and B, is kind of tired of the pestering, and he's commander-in-chief of combined fleet. He's got the bureaucratic moxie to do this, and he just, okay, well, fine, I'm going to do it, blah-blah. So issues the orders, but then what ends up happening, of course, is it's one thing to authorize the creation of First Air Fleet. It's quite another to be able to hammer out the nuts and bolts of how you actually make a multi-carrier force operate together, and that's where he basically, you know, he selects Admiral Nagumo as the commander on the basis of seniority, but he selects Genda because he knows that Genda has got the vision and basically says, okay, here are the keys to the car, you know, have fun, but it's your problem now to make sure that this thing actually works.
Well, you know, you discussed a little bit that Yamamoto had the idea that he wanted to attack Pearl Harbor. Was that always the case? Wasn't there some reluctance initially to, or was there any resistance on the part of the Navy to going and attacking Pearl Harbor?
Oh, there was a huge amount of resistance. I mean, it was seen by a number of members on the Naval General Headquarters staff as being an extraordinarily dangerous undertaking, and you know, it could end up in the sinking of these carriers, and these are fairly valuable naval implements. And so, he encountered a lot of resistance. And you'll pardon me, I'm actually not as up on the exact date. In fact, I don't even know that we know the exact date of when Yamamoto's interest, official or otherwise, began in attacking Pearl Harbor. It certainly had been there for a while, but then again, you know, there had been, even in the popular literature, novels out there talking about, you know, the next war between Japan and America that had posited that, you know, maybe the Japanese Navy would make a daring raid on Pearl or would capture Oahu. You kind of have to see the Pearl Harbor attack in the context of potential operations aimed against Oahu as well. I mean, Yamamoto thought that being able to capture that particular locale certainly would give him a useful base, but more important, would give him bargaining chip in potential negotiations with the U.S. government. You know, if I hold 300,000-400,000 U.S. citizens hostage and I've got this, you know, beautiful chunk of territory, that might be worth something. He militated for the invasion of Oahu during the same time as the attack, but Naval GHQ was just like, no way. That is not happening because we don't have enough transports to begin with, and we don't have enough troops. You know, the Army is certainly not willing to throw in another two or three divisions worth of troops, and how the Imperial Navy would have hauled, you know, two or three divisions of troops across that same watery gulf and landed them on Oahu, that is an undertaking that is an order of magnitude bolder than just the carrier attack.
Yeah, that would be an even more audacious step, but it is one of those, you know, wonder ifs. I've been guilty of the following myself, in that, you know, in hindsight, when people say, you know, how could we have been so surprised at Pearl Harbor? We should have seen it coming. You know, there's a couple of things that were written, as you mentioned, but people look back further and go, well, you know, you can look at what Billy Mitchell did, and then there was the British raid on Toronto where they attacked the Italians. It's pretty straightforward that's something that could take place. But it really is a little more complicated than that. And I don't know where they teach this at U.S. Navy PAO school about why these PAO photo events shouldn't be done. But the Kido Butai, there was a spark that got this whole idea going, and it really is kind of a blowback from our end. I wonder if you could flesh out the spark and how that timeline took place through the 1941.
Well, ostensibly, the mental spark that led to the formation of Kido Butai is Commander Genda sitting in a movie theater, I believe in the late 1930s, seeing a newsreel film of four American aircraft carriers, which obviously would have been Saratoga, Lexington, Yorktown, and Enterprise, parading in a box formation together, that they had been put together for that purpose, merely for the purpose of making a good-looking newsreel. But the Genda looks at this and begins to wonder, you know, could we actually operate four aircraft carriers together? Could we use that sort of a box formation and the tactical control that we would get by being within visual distance of each other, could we use that to create large air groups? And that was the genesis, if you will, for making Kido Butai happen. Now, I don't know. It's pretty tough to verify whether or not that was actually how things came about. That's what Genda says. I don't know that there's any independent verification of that, but that was ostensibly the seed that got planted. Just on the whole topic of inevitability and sort of the finger pointing that goes along with, you know, any sort of a large complex surprise like that. Yeah, you have a tendency to look back at things like Pearl Harbor or 9/11 and slap yourself on the forehead and say, well, geez, you know, that's obvious. I'm sure that if you had asked, you know, most human beings on the street on, you know, September 10th, 2001, whether or not, you know, they could have envisioned an attack like the one that was launched against the trade centers, most people would, you know, nobody would have said that, or there would have been a relatively small handful of people that had envisioned it, but most of them worked for Al-Qaeda. Same kind of thing going on here with Pearl Harbor, I think. Things that we tend to think of as being obvious in retrospect really are not obvious at all during the run-up to these events, because it takes some sort of a mental breakthrough and then a lot of hard work to actually, you know, iron out the details of making these things function together. It's the perspiration part that's kind of the difficult thing to overcome, and you know, if you haven't put in the same amount of perspiration that your opponent has, you get handed nasty surprises. So,
well, let me tie that back to that earlier question I asked about the things we didn't know about the Japanese that may have caused our intelligence to be less inclined to believe. I mean, you make a point in the article about it, us. You know, usually when you do a commander's estimate, you work out what are your enemy's capabilities, but that's driven by what you know or reasonably believe to know to be your enemy's capability.
Right.
And if your intelligence is so wrong as to not know that they have developed some sort of and I gather they did this on the fly, some sort of rudimentary underway replenishment system. They had, you know, this carrier cooperation. None of that was in writing. And then they had these superior torpedoes, which we totally ignored, I guess. I mean, all that had to be in place too for us to say, well, it, you know, just can't happen that way. We have something else to worry about.
Yeah, and I don't want to come across as being an apologist for naval intel in that respect, but I have a lot of sympathy for individuals who are placed in a position where they're supposed to keep tabs on another person's organization. But your information sources are crappy. Because nothing's getting out of Japan, and you as an individual don't work for an organization that has made the same conceptual leap forward that your opponent has. Just how exactly is it that you're supposed to, you know, magically come up with the answer here that your opponent has these capabilities that you can't envision yourself? It's pretty tough. And so, you know, I don't know what implications that has for, you know, gentlemen like Kimmel and Short. Certainly somebody was going to be hung out to dry as a result of that attack, but, you know, you kind of have to wonder just what was going to be expected of our naval authorities. You know, how good of a crystal ball are they really expected to have? There's no question that the U.S. Navy had anticipated that there might be some sort of a raid by a Japanese carrier or two, but in the spectrum of threats, you know, I think that somebody like Short would have told you, I think that sabotage is the more important thing for me to look out for. And nobody anticipated that, yeah, they were going to be able to bring six carriers to the party with, you know, over 300 aircraft, and that, yeah, this is technically a raid, but we're not only going to attack the naval anchorage with multiple types of armaments, but we're also going to nearly simultaneously hit every airfield on the island and crush all of the land-based air power there. Again, audacious. So, I don't know if you guys are aware, you know, just to kind of go to the other side of the coin, you know, we talk about the capabilities of Kita Butai and that they were certainly a step forward. I'm actually having a big argument right now with a listserv that I belong to. We're talking about, you know, was Kita Butai really a revolutionary advance in naval technology, if you will? And it all comes down to, well, how do you scope the revolution? I mean, are we talking about Kita Butai being revolutionary in the context of all of human existence, or is it just revolutionary within military history, or just within World War II military history, blah, 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 blah. It's a slippery term. I think that anybody would acknowledge that it was a big step forward. But then you can also take a look at some of the problems that the Japanese had during this attack. And I don't know if you guys are aware of the new book that's out by Alan Zim on Pearl Harbor.
No.
Okay. Well, Alan is actually a friend of mine, and he put out a new book that is looking at the Pearl Harbor attack from an operational standpoint. And he is a former naval officer and an operational planner by training. So he's taking all of the tools in his modern kit bag and going back and analyzing this attack. And it's called Attack on Pearl Harbor: Strategy, Combat, Myths, Deceptions. And then his name again is Alan Zim, which is Z-I-M-M. And I would recommend it to anybody who's interested in the Pearl Harbor attack, because it is by far the most important book that's come out in Pearl Harbor in the last 10 or 15 years. The thing that you come away with it, though, is that you wonder, after having read his book, you know, how it was that the Japanese even managed to tie their shoes in the morning, because Zim is extremely critical of the basic conception of the attack, the training that led up to the attack, and, of course, the execution of the attack itself. You know, things like Fuchida's mistake in firing the flare pistol ends up sending, you know, both of the attack elements in at the wrong time, for instance. And, you know, there's just a lot of sort of suboptimal delivery of weapons during that attack. I mean, you know, the dive bombers going after the Nevada when the second wave dive bombers come in, that is a very poor target choice for the Japanese. You know, 250-kilogram armor-piercing bomb can't get through the armored deck of a battleship, and so why are you expending as many dive bombers as you end up doing to go after a target that you really can't hurt all that badly when there are other juicy targets sitting around, like the four cruisers that were moored over nearer to the submarine base? So, you know, there's a number of, I don't want to say nits, but things that you can start picking apart in terms of the actual execution of the attack. And it was, as Zim rightly points out, it was not a brilliantly conceived, brilliantly executed attack. I think it is still clearly an attack that nobody else could have done except the Japanese, and is a very important step forward, but he's absolutely right in trying to recast the historical record a little bit away from the flawlessly executed, flawlessly conceived sort of common mythos, if you will.
Let's pull a thread on that a little bit. When you read about the difference between the way the Germans and the Americans versus the Japanese submarines fought the subsurface battle, one of the arguments that I've heard said that one of the weaknesses was the Japanese subskippers were really, 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 really focused on the fact they wanted to shoot the biggest warship. They did not see as much, lack of a better word, honor and bragging rights on taking out merchant ships.
Right.
Is there any thought that, you know, in exactly what you're talking about, going after the Nevada while they missed the cruisers, also the fuel infrastructure was also relatively ignored. Did that mentality, a little bit too much martial machismo, play into that? And also, what are some of the other bigger targets, kind of like the fuel depots there, that the Japanese just completely bypassed, that only would have taken a very small percentage of their strike force to effectively have eliminated?
Well, there's a number of things we can talk about there. And obviously, you know, the failure to attack the fuel tanks and the other logistical facilities is one of the sort of classic blunders that is trotted out as, you know, being important to the conduct of the attack. couple of points to be made. The Japanese Navy was what I would call an ultra-Mahanian naval force, in that, you know, they had been shrewd readers of Alfred Thayer Mahan's works, and they very much believed that sea control devolved solely from the destruction of the enemy's main battle fleet. And as a result of that, they tended not to view things like logistics as being very important. And I don't even think that that has necessarily anything to do with machismo or martial spirit. It's just that they bought into the whole notion that that, you know, sinking the other guy's warships is the only thing that really matters. As the 20s and 30s continue, and the pressures of having to fight a war against the U.S. become more and more severe. I mean, they know that in any war against us, they're going to be hideously outnumbered, certainly in terms of industrial strength. And so, you know, and at this time, of course, too, the battleship is the main arm of decision. And so the question is, how are we as the underdogs going to be able to even the odds? Because the naval treaties have told us that in terms of numbers of battleships, we are always going to be the underdog. How do we get around that? Well, the answer that they come to more and more during the 20s and 30s is that you put torpedoes on your surface ships, and you're going to use night attacks and things like that to try to attrite the U.S. battle line before you actually get into the real shooting match. And their submarines are an extension of that doctrine. So, of course, the submarines have been trained that their role is to be looking after, looking out for American capital ships and to take those out first rather than going for things like merchant ships. I actually have a question in my own mind that I've never answered. Is, you know, what would have happened if the Japanese had decided that they wanted to reorient their submarine force into more of an anti-merchant ship force? I don't know that they would have been all that successful. It's, I think, very difficult to draw analogs between the Battle of the Atlantic and what might have happened in the Pacific. I mean, among other things, the Pacific is a much larger ocean, and your target concentrations are going to be smaller, I think, as a result. Furthermore, if you look at the amount of tonnage that's actually being taken across the Atlantic, it's getting the bulk of our military tonnage after about the middle of 1942, and we're also shipping a lot of food and other items to Great Britain. We're shipping lend-lease stuff up to the Soviet Union. So there's just, in terms of absolute tonnage going across the ponds, there's a heck of a lot more going across the Atlantic than would have been going across the Pacific. So you've got less tonnage in a much bigger pond, and you've got submarines which are not nearly as nimble or well-handling or deep-diving or quick-diving as the German, you know, Type 7 and Type 9 U-boats. I really don't know that even if the Japanese had made a different decision that, yeah, we're going to use our submarines as an anti-shipping force rather than trying to pick off American capital ships, I really don't know that they would have been all that successful in that role.
After, well, I think one of the things that also interested me was you really did point out, which people rarely do, and you've discussed here a minute ago, how many simultaneous attacks were being carried out by the Japanese on December 7th. It wasn't just Pearl Harbor. They went after everything, and they had the aircraft to do that. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. That, in my opinion, is what makes the attack such a stunning development. It's that, unlike the raid against Taranto, which, don't get me wrong, is an absolutely wonderful example of how to use aircraft carriers in an offensive fashion, but, you know, the British came in, it was supposed to be a two-carrier operation. It turned out to be only a single carrier because the second flight deck had some mechanical problems. They couldn't bring her along. They hit Taranto at night with 20 aircraft and then beat feet, of course, as rapidly as possible afterwards because, you know, one carrier cannot stand up against the organic air power that's sitting on mainland Italy. So to have, you know, a year later, to have this carrier force of six carriers come in with 360 aircraft, and to attack a major naval anchorage in broad daylight, that's a pretty bold move, but they felt that they could do that because they had sufficient planes to make it happen. And so a very important part of the overall mission was not only to attack the naval anchorage, but also to suppress American land-based air power so that it could not counterattack effectively against the Japanese flight decks. So, yeah, they're hitting, all of the main airfields on Oahu. They're hitting Hickam, they're hitting Wheeler, they're hitting, the naval, the air station on Ford Island, of course, simultaneously. So, four or five different fields are all getting plastered at the same time. And, they're very effective in that role. I forget the exact numbers. I want to say that, they destroyed something on the order of 188 aircraft of all kinds and then shot up many others. So, they crushed the air power on Oahu and ensured that it was not in any position to really counterattack against their fleet.
The we were talking about Zinn, I believe his name, or Zim, his new book, where he takes modern operational planning and takes a view of it. One of the great jokes when you're doing these types of things is, the only people that really has a veto on what you want to do is God and logistics. And part
right.
The deity besides, we'll stay agnostic for a moment, but one of the really neat innovations that caught us by surprise, even if you were doing some red teaming, you would assume that unless they abandoned them somewhere in the Pacific, which I believe you wrote was actually one of their options, that to be able to get to the level of air power they had in Pearl Harbor, they would have to leave the Soryu and the Hiryu behind because they just
right.
didn't have range to get there and back. But
right.
they
which
had that,
why,
that.
That's they, why the innovation of the underway refueling is so important, of course, later on down the road, is you can actually get those two carriers there. But, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. And so that was something that kind of surprised us. I'm sure after the Klubat hit us a couple times, we realized that we needed to take that into consideration. The Japanese had that capability. Just like, the Long Lance torpedo, it took us a long time before we accepted the reality of that capability.
A really long time, like mid-1943. Yeah.
And when you get to 1943, it's really hard to look at any other innovations that the Japanese had that really surprised us. Was that a combination of our better intelligence and the fact that the Japanese were on their heels so much they couldn't focus on innovation? Or were there some things from 43 through the end of the war that the Japanese were still able to bring on to the field of battle that surprised us?
And actually, let me put the bug in your ear, too. Let's talk more about the fuel tanks, because I realize I didn't fully answer that question.
Absolutely.
The whole thing about the Japanese wanting to go after the fuel tanks is a myth, and a myth very badly in need of debunking, and so we should talk about that. In terms of innovations in the later part of the war, I think the only thing that really surprised people was the advent of the kamikaze. Certainly, we had had instances all through the war of Japanese pilots who, when their aircraft was sufficiently damaged, would try to sell their lives as dearly as possible and, would dive their aircraft into our ships or at least attempt to do so. Certainly at the Battle of Santa Cruz, Hornet got walloped by a Val that knew the game was over and that he was not going to be able to pull out of his dive. But to see that sort of tenacity and fanaticism then institutionalized and turned into an intentional weapon system on the part of a Navy that by that point had really been completely beaten. I think that was a pretty surprising and unwelcome innovation as far as the U.S. Navy was concerned. Of course, from a rational standpoint, you can kind of see where the Japanese were coming from. By the time halftime is over, and that's what I think of 1943 as really being in terms of carrier warfare, by the end of 42, both sides' carrier forces have just been beaten completely senseless, and the rest of the fighting in Guadalcanal and the Solomons is going to be conducted by surface forces while the carrier forces rebuild during 1943. Well, the end of halftime, if you will, is when we start kicking off operations against the Gilberts in October of 43, and then the attack against Truk in February of 44. When the U.S. Navy comes out after halftime, they come out of the locker room, and not only now do we have flight decks like the Essex class, but we have introduced VT fusing into our 5-inch weapons. We have every available piece of real estate is festooned with 40-millimeter and 20-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. We have a second-generation fighter in the F-6F Hellcat. We have, you know, we've got the Combat Information Center going on our carriers. We figured out fighter direction. So a friend of mine, David Dixon, argues that really what we have is Navy 2.0, if you will. It's a completely different force, both qualitatively and quantitatively. And it means that our defensive capabilities are just orders of magnitude more lethal than they had been in, you know, the beginning and middle of 1942. So if you're a Japanese strike commander and you're trying to raid these forces, I mean, flying into American fleet air defense in 1944 is akin to committing suicide in any way, you know, in any fashion. So kamikaze is a more effective weapons platform because you don't have to worry about pulling out and you're able to, you know, jink and maneuver and do all that kind of stuff. It was a much superior way of delivering a bomb onto the deck of an enemy warship. Unfortunately, it also consumes the aircraft and the pilot, but that was the only way that they had a realistic chance of getting a hit on us. So,
did you? I want to go back to the fuel tanks because I'm not sure. Did you completely? Other than the fact you say it's a myth. I mean, discuss the oversight?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, we've all seen the movie Tora, 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 right? And so we know that after the attack went down, Commander Fuchida flies his plane back to the Akagi, and you know, he's mentally earmarking the fuel tanks and all that good stuff, and he gets out of his plane and he runs up to the bridge of the Akagi and says, you know, we have to go back, we have to go back, we got to attack these guys again, got to get the fuel tanks, and Nagumo overrules him and the force goes home. That's something that's been beaten into our, you know, sort of collective World War II memory, if you will, by any number of things, Tora, Tora, Tora being one, and some of the accounts that you get out of books by Gordon Prang. Well, it turns out that never happened, that in fact there was never any discussion on the bridge of Akagi. Fuchida never made the recommendation that the fuel tanks be hit. And this was first blown apart by a historian, a very well-regarded one, named Ned Wilmot, H.P. Wilmot, in his Pearl Harbor book that came out about 10 years ago. The deal is that if you look at Fuchida's accounts that he gives after the war, he's interviewed by the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, and they ask him point blank in 1946, why didn't you guys hit us again? And his answer at that time was, well, you know, from what we could tell, we had sunk four battleships. We had therefore accomplished the objectives that had been set out for us, and the remainder of the attack assessments weren't really in for a couple of days afterwards in any case, and so we thought we had done a good enough job, and we went for home. And none of the other officers that were interviewed at that time made any mention of it either. I think what ends up happening is that Fuchida was a very bright guy, and I think that was his first exposure to the notion that, oh, you know, the Americans think that maybe we kind of goofed up there by not hitting their fuel tanks. I wonder what's up with that. Such that when he is giving his interviews to Gordon Prang in 1963, he's changed his story, and now he, you know, paints himself as being the guy who really thought that we should go after the fuel tanks. I think, again, going back to this issue of a Navy that is ultra-Mahanian in its outlook, Fuchida asserting that he made this, you know, made this determination that he had to go after the fuel tanks amounts to him renouncing all of his naval training and indoctrination. That would have been absolutely contrary to the sort of Navy that the Japanese Navy was. And in fact, if you look at the targeting orders that were given to Kido Butai before the attack, there are six items on those orders, and I can't remember all of them exactly, but, you know, carriers are at the very top, followed by battleships, followed by cruisers and smaller combatants, followed by merchant ships, and at the very bottom of the list are the fuel tanks and logistics facilities. Well, you know, if you look at the progress of the attack at that point, the Japanese had barely chewed through items number two and were kind of partway into, you know, target priority number three. So now you're going to tell me that Fuchida has this revelation that, hey, we should really jump to the bottom of the target list and have at it. You know, that's a pretty stunning revelation. So likewise, Genda says in his memoirs that this mythical discussion of, you know, on the bridge of the Akagi, it never took place. So I think what happened is Fuchida kind of comes out with his account, and people in Japan don't like calling other people liars. So, you know, the fact that he puts that in writing first, he's kind of daring anybody else to, you know, call him a liar on it, and nobody is willing to do so. And in fact, it got so bad later on down the road that there was an account that I heard from some guy who knew an American naval officer who in turn had gotten to know Fuchida personally, and this naval officer, retired naval officer, had asked Fuchida, you know, why didn't you go after our fuel tanks? And Fuchida said, oh, well, you know, after we invaded Oahu, we wanted to be able to use that gasoline, so that's why we intentionally left those fuel tanks alone. Which, again, Fuchida was a commander. He was not at all privy to, you know, any sort of ruminations around, you know, invading Hawaii and or any of that sort of stuff. So his story continued morphing, I think, the farther on it went. And, yeah, the result is that the whole notion of having gone after the fuel tanks is nonsense. The other thing that I'll point out is that Zim does a very interesting analysis of what would it actually have taken to destroy those fuel tanks. I mean, you have this mental image of, you know, flick your Bic and the whole thing just goes up in flames, right? But all of these fuel tanks were individually revetted so that, you know, if a spill happened in one of the tanks, the earth berms around it was sufficient to contain the volume of oil that was in the tank. So they're all physically separated. There are two different tank farms around. We've got a lot of anti-aircraft over the harbor, as the second wave Japanese pilots will tell you. You know, and fuel tanks too are not the kind of thing that you can just strafe and necessarily blow up. I mean, they're relatively heavy gauge steel. Your machine gun bullets aren't going to have much luck with them. You know, cannon shells, yeah, maybe. And the other thing is the fuel oil doesn't really burn all that well necessarily. So it's not like aviation gasoline where it's, you know, highly volatile. The bottom line is that in Alan Zim's opinion, it would have been a very difficult undertaking to actually destroy those facilities.
They both come up in our conversation, and I wanted to touch on two of the, especially when you back up and you look at the loss rate of both the land-based and especially carrier-based aviation, the pilots, it's unreal, the percentage of people that were killed. But at the end of the war, two of the major players and significant players, Minoru Genda and Mitsuo Fuchida, they survived the war, and they both actually, you know, lived for quite a long time through their expected Japanese life expectancy. But they both took different paths after the war. And if you look at where they were at the beginning of the war and the path they took afterwards, was that what you would have expected, those two types of personalities, or is there a significant change after the war for one or both of them that led them on those different paths?
That's a very interesting question. Genda, I think, is clearly the brighter of the two, if you will. So Genda ends up going in into the Japanese self-defense forces and rises to the rank of general afterwards. And then after that becomes a very successful politician. And I don't see that as being an outlier at all. I look at Genda and I think this is a very, very bright guy, very competent individual. Yeah, he made some mistakes at places like Midway, and we could drink another beer and talk for another hour over Midway. But yeah, I don't find that trajectory in terms of his career surprising at all. Fuchida is the interesting story there, because of course Fuchida famously becomes a Christian missionary and puts out a book talking about his conversion to Christianity. I have a somewhat jaundiced take on that, if you will, and I should be very careful in how I express this, because there's actually a gentleman that I respect very greatly, a guy named Martin Bennett, who's working on a screenplay on Fuchida's life. And Bennett is a very committed Christian and has a different take on Fuchida's trajectory than I do. I perhaps am a more cynical individual. Okay, so I look at Fuchida. It's the end of the war. He's out of the military. The guy becomes a dirt farmer. And I don't know how much you know about economic conditions in Japan immediately after the war, but they were horrendous. I mean, we had basically knocked their economy back to the Bronze Age, you know, and rightly, okay? But it was very, very hard to make a living as a former naval officer at this point. So he's a dirt farmer. His life is not good. And he ends up making this conversion to Christianity. And I don't know how genuine it was or not, but I do know that conversion gave him the ability to reinvent himself. He was able to get out of the career, if you will call it, that he had been in, and now he becomes a minister. And it's interesting because post-war Japan had a fluidity to the cultural scene that was absent for years and years before that, and you know, arguably for years after as well. But there was a lot of sort of reinvention and people deciding, you know, I don't have to be the same kind of person I was during the war years. And I think so Fuchida becomes a missionary, he becomes a minister, he starts getting back in touch with U.S. veterans, he becomes friends with historians like Gordon Prang. He comes over to the various reunions, he's treated like a rock star, and Fuchida is the kind of guy who likes that. I mean, when I read his accounts of the Pacific War, I look at him and I say, well, here's a man who very much likes to be treated as an exceptional person, as someone who is perhaps more prescient than he actually was. But, you know, he tells a good war story. He'd be fun to have a beer with. He's bright. He's charismatic. And, you know, that conversion to Christianity allows him to sort of assume the persona to get back a little bit of his rock star status, if you will. So I'm sure that there are just all sorts of complex motivations going on there. I can't imagine trying to psychoanalyze Mitsuo Fuchida. He was a very complex guy, but yeah, his career track is definitely the more interesting of the two.
Well, first, let me accept your gracious acceptance of coming on our show to discuss Midway at a later date.
I would love to. No, I'd love to. Absolutely, and I am drinking a beer as we're doing this, and I would promise to drink another beer as we did that one. But yeah, that would be a real hoot.
We'll take care of that.
Also, on a social note, go Navy, beat Army. I was down in New Orleans the last few days. The World War II Museum down there was having a conference, and I was speaking. And my agent, Jim Hornfisher, who has written, you know, three very well accepted books on naval history, just recently came out with a very good book called Neptune's Inferno that talks about naval combat in Guadalcanal. Big Jimmy skipped the final banquet last night or two nights ago so that he could catch a plane out of New Orleans back to D.C. so that he could make it for the Army-Navy game, and I know that he was absolutely thrilled by the outcome. So I missed him at dinner, but I'm glad that he was able to make the game. In any case, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Well, that's all right. We had Jim on the show recently to discuss Neptune's Inferno, as a matter of fact. So, in fact, we're going to get him on again. He doesn't know that yet. But,
he's a great guy. Oh, he's so much fun.
As you were writing these pieces on both Midway and on Pearl Harbor, what surprised you the most during your research?
Wow.
Yeah, you got a few minutes to answer that.
Yeah. Certainly, in terms of Midway, you know, that kind of revolves around Fuchida as well. I mean, I think there are a number of myths that we end up debunking in the Midway book, and probably the most prominent of them is what was going on the flight decks right before the 1024 to 1020 to 1025 dive bombing attack that turns the tide of the battle. And that is all very much based on what Fuchida says in his book, Midway, the Battle That Doomed Japan. And Tony Tully, my co-author, and I had been, you know, eking forward and putting together the account of this thing, and we'd gotten a hold of the Carrier Air Group records. They'd been very kindly translated for us by a guy named Jim Sawruck up in Pennsylvania, and he forwards these things to us. And what they're telling us in terms of what was going on in the Japanese flight decks really did not jibe with what Fuchida was saying. And at the same time, Fuchida's account basically says that, you know, there was this reserve strike force of aircraft that had been ordered to be armed against ships, armed with torpedoes, and that strike force was on the flight deck during most of the morning. Of course, it had to be hauled off the flight deck and rearmed and then re-rearmed in a couple of occasions. But his basic tenet is that the strike force was always on the flight deck, and that at the time of the dive bombing attack, our aircraft were warmed up, ready to go, and just minutes away from, you know, counterattacking against the Americans, and then it all gets, you know, snatched away from us. Well, there started to be some holes that were appearing in this veneer, and we were getting more and more curious about that. John Lundstrom, who is, in my opinion, you know, pretty much the finest naval historian on the planet, ended up having one of these epiphanies where he was looking at some of the photographs that had been taken of the Japanese carriers during that battle by B-17s, and there were no aircraft on the flight deck. And in one of those sort of, you know, the obvious becoming obvious moments, you know, John is like, wait a minute, you know? And he, you know, he calls me and he's like, what's going on here, John? And I'm like, I have no idea. Well, long story short, I finally put together two letters to two separate Japanese historians. And I was operating under the assumption that, you know, Mitsuo Fuchida, a famous war hero, I got to be very, very careful how I couch these questions so that I don't end up insulting a guy who's, you know, a national hero. And I asked the question of, you know, I'm reading Fuchida's account and I'm looking at the operational records and these things don't seem to jibe. Can you help me understand what's going on here? Off the letters go. The letters come back about 2-3 weeks later, and one of them starts out by saying, to understand why Fuchida's account is a pack of transparent lies. You know,
that's subtle.
Yeah. And for a Japanese person to just come right out and just slap somebody like that was, you know, I've lived in Japan. They are a very polite people, and you don't do stuff like that. I you know, you had to scrape my jaw off the floor. I was laughing for 10 minutes. And he concludes this paragraph by saying, if it's true what you're telling me, John, that Fuchida's book is one of the few that remains translated into English at this point, it's a funny story. You know, i.e., where have you guys been? You know, what's up with your scholarship that you still actually buy what Fuchida is telling you? So that I would have to say is the biggest gobsmacker of the entire process for me.
That is funny. Hey, in a couple minutes, one thing I want to pull the thread on with you. I think I've used that phrase twice this show. My apologies. You mentioned you lived in Japan, and one of the very few regrets I had when I was on active duty, I had a chance to do some exercises with the Japanese Navy. They're great professionals. Nobody takes better care of a ship or
that's
an aircraft, the Japanese. Oh, they're just incredible. And
you can
ask
eat
anybody,
off the decks, right? Yeah.
Ask anybody who's been in a shipyard or had depot-level maintenance done it by the Japanese. They'll have nothing but good things to say. But the question I have for you is, have the Japanese military, I know their general culture when they think of World War II, there's always the understandable taint of tragedy associated with it. But have we reached the point now that at least in the Japanese military, that they can, there's enough distance where they can appreciate some of that operational and tactical excellence and some of their really, lack of a better phrase, things that they can be proud of that they were able to do just strictly from a isolated professional level militarily? Or is that still a subject that's too taboo for them to touch on?
I don't really know the answer to that, to be honest. I have not been in contact with many of their professionals. The only guy that I know from the Imperial Navy is a gentleman named Yoji Koda, who retired as the commander-in-chief of their Naval Self-Defense Forces. I was privileged to get to know him as a result of some of the lectures I've done at the U.S. Naval War College. Koda-san is an incredible scholar of World War II, knows all the ins and outs and the details of those battles. And so I think that there are certainly individuals within that Navy that can see, both edges of the sword, if you will, the pros and the cons of what their Navy went through. But, certainly an individual like Koda knows everything that went into that attack and what went wrong. So, and there's some very fine, naval historians too, like Tomatsu Haruo is a very good scholar. He was one of the co-authors of H.P. Wilmot's Pearl Harbor book, and I'm quite sure that's the reason that Wilmot got such a lot of the good dirt, if you will, on the whole tank farm thing. It was because he had Tomatsu sensei in his corner. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff over there. I just wish I could read it, and I'm hopeful that the language barriers are going to continue to go away as tools like Google and so forth become more and more prevalent. I hope that those linguistic barriers are going to come down so that mere mortals can actually read that stuff.
Well, on that note, thank you very much. That was a very, very fast hour.
I've enjoyed this immensely, and I would be more than happy to come back and yak about Midway at some point. So let me know.
We'll put that date right down.
All righty.
We definitely want to have, and I appreciate the hour, and I just want to recommend everybody, go ahead and look it up. No kidding. I think who did the review there? Was it Norman Friedman or the other Norman?
No, Palmar.
Norman Palmar. He did a real great review of Shattered Sword. That was John's book on the Battle of Midway. Some people say everything that's been written can be written, but I think we've given you a few things today to say, hey, more stuff is coming out every year, and if this is an area of interest, you owe it to yourself to dig into it. And I hope you have a great week, John.
Thanks very much, guys. Happy holidays.
Thank you, John. Merry All Christmas right. and Happy New Year to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks for everybody for joining us live or getting us on archive. We'll have one more live show before we have a Christmas best of. So we'll see you next week for another edition of MidRats. Hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.